I know that there were many, many times that he stood over a woman he had just hurt, watching her cry. Just like me. Just like him. What I have always dreaded, always feared is happening, is coming true. I am turning into him. I blink at her lying there on the floor, my heart racing, my lungs unable to fill. I can't breathe. I can't look away. I am so filled with horror and revulsion and self-hate, I want to die. It was only a matter of time. My fingers unfurl and my hands are shaking uncontrollably. I want to reach for her, to help her, to bandage her wrist and apologize for frightening her, for yelling at her, but I don't trust myself. If I am turning into my father, next time I might do worse than just raise my fist. I might actually use it. The best thing I can do, the only thing I can do, is leave her, put as much distance as possible between her and me. I leap over her huddled body, bolt out the front door barefoot, into the dark night, and start running. It's a while before I stop, and I do only because my feet don't have calluses sufficient for running through the woods at night. They are cut up and bleeding from rocks and twigs and uneven ground. They hurt. I deserve it. I don't know where that violent, beastly scream came from, but I know it scared her enough to cause her to slip and fall and hurt herself. I know I am the cause of her injury, and I hate myself for it. I'm not sure where I am, but I was going southeast, toward Baxter Park, when I left the house, so I assume I've come up on Dacey Pond at this point. I wade in, letting my feet squish into the cold mud. It eases the sharp physical pain in my soles, but nothing can lessen the anguish in my heart. I have hurt someone. For the first time in my quiet life, I have hurt someone. And worst of all, I have hurt someone I love. Looking up at the dark sky, I consider my options now. Not that she still wants me after what I did, but I definitely don't trust myself around her now. If she should mention being together or, God forbid, having children who might inherit and carry the genes of my insane father, I can't guarantee that I won't lose it again. My God, I raised my fist to her. If she'd kept talking, would I have actually hit her? I feel sick at the thought. I want to believe that nothing could ever lead me to harm her, but I know what lives inside me. I don't, I cannot trust myself. Live quiet, and no matter what happens inside of you, you won't never be able to hurt someone, Cassidy. It's what your mama would want. Gramps' words come back to me, as right and true as the day he said them. I allowed Bryn to get too close to me. I allowed myself to get too close to her. I have put her in jeopardy. The very thought makes me sob. Tears stream down my face as I throw my head back and scream to the dark, unforgiving heavens. I'm sorry. I'm so goddamn sorry. A drop of water plops on my forehead. It's joined by another and another and another, dotting my face and wetting my shirt, mixing with my tears and washing me clean. And the answer comes to me quickly. To keep her safe, send her away. If you love her, let her go. There is redemption only through action. There is peace only through righteousness. I know what I have to do. I take my time hiking back to the homestead because I need Bryn to be asleep when I get there. Gramp kept a glass bottle of ether in the root cellar, mostly for the animals. He'd use it if they were injured or once for a cow during the breech birth of her calf. At the end of her life, when Mama was in terrible pain and the fentanyl prescribed by her doctor wasn't helping anymore, Gramp would apply a bit of ether to a rag and set it over her nose and mouth so she could sleep easier. I know how to use it. Bryn must leave, and she can't come back looking for me. I need to get her away from me, somewhere safe, as soon as possible. On its own, a fight in the kitchen like ours, an intense emotional conflict between an otherwise loving young couple, might not warrant more than cursory concern. In fact, between two normal people, such anger without name-calling, threats, or actual physical violence might even be chalked up to passionate argument. But I am not normal. Now that it's begun, it's only a matter of time before my behavior will escalate, and Bryn must be far away from me when that happens. My plan is to use the ether to drug her while she sleeps so she stays unconscious, bundle her up in a blanket on my lap, and drive her to Millinocket under cover of night. I'll find somewhere safe to leave her and then I'll return home to start packing up. I'll shut up my house as best I can and disappear into the wilderness. I will find somewhere else to live quiet, and this time I won't allow myself to diverge from that course. And if the madness gets bad enough, I gulp with the heaviness of my thoughts. Then I will take my own life. When I get home, I detour to the barn, then head to the house. It's quiet, and the clock in the tidy kitchen reads 1:10. I move soundlessly across the living room carpet to Bryn's room and step through the doorway. I swallow back the meager contents of my stomach when I see the state of her room and my sweet girl. She is sleeping on her side, tissues littering the floor by the bed, her wrist wrapped in a dish towel. Hurt and sad, she must have cried herself to sleep, and my heart aches with love and sorrow and regret. It never, ever should have come to this. You did this to her. You, Cassidy. My fingers tighten around the ether bottle and rag by my side. Now do what's right. Make it right. So I do. It's a slow ride from my place into Millinocket, and it takes a little over 2 hours. The roads are mostly empty. They're often quiet anyway. But from 2 to 4 on a weekday morning, almost no one is around, which is good. I know where the police station is for my very occasional visits to town. It's behind the post office, where Gramp used to collect his government checks. My plan is to park close by and carry Bryn to the entrance. I'll leave her there and drive home. When I stop the quad in the far corner of the parking lot, near the road, I don't see anyone around. Bryn hasn't stirred much during our trip, though I've redosed her twice just to be sure she didn't wake up. I stopped feeling my arms halfway through the trip since she was lying across my lap. Now I cut the engine, looking down at her face. I love you, I wish I could say. And if things were different, I'd love you forever, my sweet angel. Thank you for giving me the happiest days of my sorry life. Thank you for seeing the good in me when I know there is so much bad deep inside. Thank you for loving me when I was certain I'd spend the rest of my life unloved. I promise, I give you my most sacred vow that I will never come looking for you again. I will leave you alone to find happiness. I will leave you alone so that I know you're safe. You are, and will forever be, my life's greatest treasure, and I will still be loving you on the day I die. Bryn Cadogan. I clutch her against me, clenching my leaking eyes closed as I lean my forehead against hers and breathe her in one final time. Don't come looking for me, I beg her. If I ever see you again, I'll never be able to let you go. I gather her into my arms and stand up, pressing my lips to her forehead and holding them there for a long moment. It is a certain kind of death march as I walk slowly across the dark parking lot to the nondescript brick building before me, because my life will be colorless and loveless when I leave her and go. But still my feet move forward in their labor because I love her, and I suspect my descent into madness has already begun. Finally, I am near the door, where I find a bench. I can place her on it, and she'll be just to the left of the police station door. Someone will find her quickly, or when she wakes up, she'll figure out where she is right away. Certainly no one will bother her this close to the station entrance. It's my best chance at leaving her somewhere safe. Standing behind the back of the bench, I lower her gently before taking a step away. To my right, there is a bulletin board, and a notice behind the glass catches my eye. Tip line open. Missing woman / dead man. The Millinocket Police Department is seeking information about the disappearance of a woman from the Chimney Pond Trail on June 19th. In conjunction, police seek information regarding the stabbing death of a man found in an Appalachian Trail lean-to 1/4 mile west of the Chimney Pond Ranger Station on June 21st. Events possibly related. Any details can be forwarded to the MPD. My held breath burns my lungs as I read and reread the notice once, twice, 3 horrifying times. It cannot be a coincidence. Bryn is the missing woman. Wayne, her attacker, is the dead man. My mind flashes back to that afternoon, to hearing Bryn scream, to finding Wayne stabbing her, to throwing him across the lean-to where he remained unconscious until I left with her. No, not unconscious. Dead. I... Oh, my God. Oh, my God, no. I killed him. I killed a human being. Bryn stirs in her sleep, whimpering softly, but I turn away from her and I don't look back. I turn over my quad and zoom out of the parking lot like the devil's on my heels. She will be safe now, and that's all that matters. As for me, I am damned. I am a murderer now. Just like my father.
Chapter 29. Bryn. I don't know where I am. I just know that I'm not in bed because it's hard and cold. If I was in bed, Cassidy would be keeping me warm. I blink my eyes open and try to orient myself, but I have no idea what I'm looking at. Pushing myself into a sitting position, I realize that I'm fully dressed, outdoors on a bench beside a red brick building. Where the hell am I? As I twist my head to look around, it throbs like crazy and I wince, pressing my fingers to my temples. What happened? The last thing I remember is crying myself to sleep after our fight. Our terrible fight in the kitchen when I pressured Cassidy to imagine a life with me, and he rejected me without exception, then left me hurting and alone on the floor. A sob rises in my throat, but I swallow it back. My head aches and my eyes burn. I have no idea where I am, but hysterics won't help me figure it out. I reach for my wrist and find it wrapped carefully with an aced bandage. My braided bracelet moved to my other wrist. Did Cassidy do that while I was sleeping? Did he bring me to town to have it checked out? Surely not. He treated my stab wounds himself. Where is he? Cass? I call weakly, looking around at the parking lot behind me. There are only 3 cars parked and no ATV. I look up at the sky, noting that the sun is on the rise. I'm guessing it's about 6 o'clock. The world is still waking up. Cassidy! I call again, standing up. This is when I realize I have shoes on. I haven't worn shoes in weeks, so the hiking boots I wore to hike Katahdin feel heavy and confining on my feet. I didn't even realize that Cassidy had saved them, but feeling them on my feet feels wrong, feels like bad news that I don't want to hear. I scan the parking area for Cassidy's ATV because there's no other way I could have gotten here. But I don't see him. I don't hear the quad's motor nearby, either. Looking down, I realize there is a note pinned to my shirt, and I unpin it, holding it up. Sweet Bryn, this was the only way. You asked if I love you, and the answer is yes, so much that I have to let you go. You will always be my treasure, and I will never, ever forget you. But you are better off without me, I promise. For both our sakes, please don't come looking for me. Cass. P.S. Your wrist is sprained. Ice it when you wake up. I inhale sharply, my fingers shaking as I read and reread the short message, its stark and horrible meaning sinking in. I stare at the beautiful, ruthless letters that have severed my life from his. He loves me, but he has gone to drastic measures to keep us apart, and it rips my heart in two. He's left me here. He's gone. My stomach clenches and my knees weaken, forcing me back down on the bench. I lean forward on my knees, afraid I'm going to be sick.
Miss? Miss? I just seen you out here. Can I help you?
I turn to look behind me. I see a glass door being held open by a portly, uniformed officer.
Miss, are you okay?
No. No, I am not okay. Not at all. I don't know. Where am I?
You're in Millinocket, Maine, at the police station,
he says, gesturing to the words on the door.
Why don't you come on in? I have a pot of hot coffee brewing.
No, I have to find... Who? Cassidy? No, Bryn, Cassidy's gone. No matter how much he claims to love you, it wasn't enough to want a future with you.
Miss, you don't look too good. What's your name?
Bryn Cadogan.
Bryn Elizabeth Cadogan.
I nod, distracted from the pain in my heart by the fact that this person knows my middle name.
Well, good Lord,
he says, opening the door a little wider.
We've been looking everywhere for you.
For me?
Oh, yeah, miss. For you.
I tilt my head to the side and walk into the small police department, watching as he opens a leaf in the countertop and rounds the counter to sit behind the desk.
Bryn Cadogan, your parents been sick about you. They've been staying over at the Ferguson Lake Lodge on Route 11. Been up that mountain about 100 times looking for you, don't you know?
My parents, I gasp. They're here?
Aye, at the Ferguson Lake Lodge.
How long have they been here?
2 weeks? 3, maybe? Don't know exactly, but we see Colin and Jenny least every other day. They come by looking for leads.
The officer cocks his head.
If you don't mind my asking, what in Sam Hell happened to you?
I place my palms on the reception desk between us, my fingers white and rigid. I was hiking Katahdin a few weeks ago. I was attacked in an AT lean-to.
Yup.
He nods, like he knows, unaccountably, that this is so.
On June 19.
That's right. I rub my forehead, the bruising headache getting worse, and my stomach still roiling, though I haven't eaten anything since lunch yesterday. I was, a little bit west of the Chimney Pond saddle merge when a man named, named Wayne attacked me.
Huh,
he murmurs, squinting his eyes and pursing his lips like something isn't quite adding up.
You say his name was Wayne?
Yes, Wayne. He stabbed me. I hear the front door open behind me, and the officer I'm speaking to makes eye contact with someone over my shoulder.
Morning, Marty. I think you're gonna want to hear this.
Hear this. Another officer, dressed in street clothes and slightly younger than the first, opens the leaf in the counter and faces me. He looks me over, his brown eyes keen, before nodding slowly.
Bryn Elizabeth Cadogan,
he says, staring at my face. Yes, sir.
Where you been?
The first officer clears his throat and nods.
Go ahead and tell Marty what you just told me.
I was attacked on the saddle trail, a little ways up from the Chimney Pond merge. I had skinned my knee and wanted to bandage it up. I stopped in at a lean-to and the relentless rain. Wayne's smile. Want me to take a look-see at your kneesy? It all comes rushing back, and the room spins, so I clench my eyes shut.
Take your time,
says Marty.
Lou, get her a cup of water, eh?
I take a deep, shaking breath and open my eyes. There was a man there, named Wayne. He threw me against the wall, and he... My hand falls to my hip. He stabbed me. He stabbed me 6 times. Marty tilts his head to the side, then rubs his chin.
Wayne, you say?
Wayne. I nod, twisting the braided bracelet that Cassidy gave to me. He said his name was Wayne.
Huh.
Marty is perched on the side of Lou's desk with a cup of coffee in one hand and a laptop bag on his other shoulder. He points to a nondescript gray metal desk a few feet behind him.
I think we better sit down to sort this out. Come with me, miss?
He opens the leaf in the counter and I follow him to his desk. He gestures to a beat-up, padded chair, and I sit down, gratefully taking the cup of water that Lou offers. I take a sip, letting the coolness sluice down my throat, and suddenly my eyes fill with tears. Cassidy brought me here. He left me here. He is gone and believes I am better off without him, even though he loves me. Even after I told him I loved him. Even though we love each other, he isn't willing to give us a chance. A sudden pain in my chest makes me cover my heart with my palm. I whimper softly, and I think I'm going to be sick. I close my eyes, leaning my chin on my chest.
"Just breathe a minute, miss,"
says Marty.
"I'll get some fresh air in here."
I hear the sound of a window opening, and suddenly the sounds of humanity fill the room. The hum of a car engine, the footfalls of a jogger, the buzz of a cell phone. I am so far from Cassidy now. He has abandoned me here. I am all alone. Your parents been sick about you. They've been staying over at the Ferguson Lake Lodge on Route 11. As tears roll down my face, I am overwhelmed with a longing to see my parents. I want my mom and dad.
Of course. But first, Miss Cadogan, we really need to hear your story,
says Marty, sitting back down at the desk.
Do you think you could just tell me what happened out there?
I take a deep breath and look up. And then I can go see them.
After we get your statement, I'll drive you over there myself.
He clicks the top of a pen and positions it over a notepad.
Let's go back to that day. You were hiking the AT.
Not the AT. Just Katahdin.
Alone?
No, I shake my head. With a group, at first. Two girls from Williams. They turned back because of the rain.
But you kept going.
I gulp, remembering the girls trying to get me to go back with them. At the time, I was determined to keep walking for Jem. And if I hadn't, I never would have met Cass. My broken heart weeps. Will I ever see Cass again?
Miss Cadogan, you kept walking, and then what?
The rain was coming down hard, and I slipped. I skinned my knee.
Then what? Take your time.
We had met a man named Wayne at Roaring Brook. He was aggressive with us, called us names. He was... You're just tourists in my dreams. I shake my head. He was off. We knew he was off from the start. Something wasn't right about him, and we sensed it. He wanted to hike with us, but we said no, and he got angry. And then these guys from...
Bennington College,
asks Marty. My neck jerks up, and I search his face. Yeah, Bennington. How did you...
We've talked to them a few times. Them and the girls. They were the last to see you that day.
He grimaces.
You skinned your knee. What happened next?
I saw the lean-to through the rain, so I walked over to it, thinking I could patch up my knee and wait out the storm, but Wayne was... Well, if it ain't Grandma. My heart is racing like crazy. Oh, God, I sob, the events of that terrible day closing in around me.
Slow down now, says Marty. Easy. Breathe in.
I close my eyes and take a deep breath, opening them as I exhale.
That's right, says Marty. Now go back to this Wayne.
Yes, Wayne. He drank some tea and alcohol. Scotch, I think. He was still angry that we didn't let him walk with us. He threw me against the wall and
he stabbed you.
My hand has moved to my hip, and I slide up my shirt a little, looking down at two of the pink scars that are still healing. 6 times.
All we ever found was your backpack. Nothing else,
says Marty.
How'd you fight him off?
I didn't. I was dying.
How'd you get away?
Asked Lou, who was standing behind Marty, staring at me intently. I was saved, I whisper, bowing my head as tears stream down my cheeks.
By who?
I look up at the officers and gulp over the lump in my throat. A man named Cassidy Porter. Marty and Lou snap their necks around to face each other so fast, I'm surprised I don't hear twin cracking sounds.
Porter?
confirms Lou, eyeing me like I've said something completely crazy. I nod. Cassidy Porter. Marty clears his throat, leaning away from me, his face a mixture of disbelief and confusion. He looks down at his notepad, then back up at me, tapping his pen between his fingers.
Let me be sure I got this straight. You say you were attacked by a guy named Wayne and rescued by a guy called Cassidy Porter?
Yes, I whisper, looking at Marty's stunned expression.
Miss Cadogan,
says Marty, rubbing his chin before dropping the pen on his notepad and looking back up at me.
That's impossible.
I'm telling the truth.
You can't be,
he says evenly. I am. A man named Wayne attacked me. A man named Cass...
Miss Cadogan, Cassidy Porter is dead.
With those four words, all the air is sucked out of the room, and I am like a fish on the carpet, flip-flopping like crazy, trying to breathe.
Calm down now, Miss Cadogan. Breathe deep.
Marty is pushing the cup of water into my hands, and I raise it to my mouth with a shaking hand, taking a messy sip. What are you talking about? I rasp, my voice breathy and breaking. No. I was just with him. Just last night. What are you...
Slow down.
Marty holds a hand up, turning slightly to Lou.
We got a blanket back there. I think she's in shock.
I am not in shock. Cassidy Porter is not dead. He's... Marty backs his chair away from the desk and rolls it over to me until we are almost knee to knee. His voice is gentle.
You've been through a tough time.
Cassidy Porter isn't dead, I sob, circling my thumb and forefinger around the bracelet he gave to me. But honestly, I can't account for the time between falling asleep last night and waking up here. Something could have happened to him. Maybe that's how I ended up here.
He is, says Marty. I can say that with 100% certainty.
My heart drops like it's made of lead. This happened last night? I shake my head as more tears blur my vision. What happened to him? Oh my God, please no. Please no, I don't understand. Lou returns with the blanket and puts it around my shoulders. Although I didn't want it, I pull it around myself. My hands are shaking and my mind is racing. Please, tell me, I beg, looking up at Marty. Marty nods, sliding a finger from a mesh basket to his desktop and opening it. His fingers trace neatly typed details, finally stopping at a paragraph mid-page.
You were reported missing on June 25th. Your parents received a call from an anonymous source who left them a voice message saying that you had been injured but you were okay. With no other information, they were understandably concerned. They reported you missing and arrived here on June 26th to look for you.
I don't care about any of this. I need to know what happened to Cass. Cassidy Porter, what happened to Cass? I sob.
Just follow me here, Ms. Cadogan, says Marty.
He drops his eyes back to the typed page.
We found a man in the lean-to you're talking about. He was found dead on the morning of June 20th, reported by a couple of early morning hikers. He was found on his stomach, and there was a knife through his heart. He'd been dead for about 18 hours by the time we recovered his body. We found your backpack nearby, and your... well, a good concentration of your blood in one corner of the lean-to. What we found was a match to your parents, so we know you were attacked there. But a week of bloodhounds searching the mountain turned up nothing. You were in the wind.
Because Cassidy carried me home on his back.
Cassidy,
Marty mumbles, shaking his head.
Well, I don't know about that. What I do know is that the man didn't have any ID on him, so we ran a DNA test to see if there were any matches in the system.
He pauses, and I brace myself because I can sense that something terrible is coming.
And there was one parental match with a 99.9% certainty. The man who attacked you, the dead man you keep calling Wayne, was born Cassidy Porter, the only son of Paul Isaac Porter.
My mind flashes back. Paul and Cass, father-son cookout 1995.
You know who he was? Paul Isaac Porter.
Paul? I say. Cassidy's father.
Yes.
Marty is staring at me like he's afraid my head might explode.
But he was also...
Wait, so you're saying... I clear my throat. You're saying that Wayne, the man who attacked me... My aching brain is desperately trying to keep up. You're saying that Wayne's real name was Cassidy Porter? Marty nods slowly.
Yes, I am saying that I am positive beyond any shadow of a doubt that the man who attacked you in a lean-to on June 19th and died in that lean-to on June 19th was born Cassidy Porter. His DNA was a match to Paul Isaac Porter, who only had one son, Cassidy, born at Millinocket General Hospital on Sunday, April 15th, 1990.
But that makes no sense. I was saved by a man named Cassidy Porter.
I don't see how that's possible,
says Marty, flipping through the file until he comes to a DNA test.
Unless there are two Cassidy Porters, which feels mighty unlikely. The man who attacked you had a birth record on file. The DNA match was definitive. Father was Paul Isaac Porter.
Marty flips through a few pages in the file and stops at the results of an official DNA test.
And just to be absolutely certain of his identity, we compared the DNA to his only living relative, a great uncle on his mother's side named, Lou, you remember the uncle's name? Name of Bert Cleary,
says Lou over his shoulder. He's sitting back at the reception desk listening to our conversation.
Right. Bert Cleary. Lives over in, Wolfboro, New Hampshire. Matched up perfect. Rosemary Cleary was his mama. Paul Isaac Porter was his daddy. Just like on his birth certificate. Open and shut case. The man who attacked you, who died in that lean-to, was Cassidy Porter.
Why did he call himself Wayne? Marty shrugs.
Maybe an alias? I don't know, miss.
He pauses, staring at me with narrowed eyes, his voice level but heavy.
Miss Cadogan, have you ever heard of Paul Isaac Porter? I mean, aside from his being Cassidy Porter's daddy.
I shake my head, a sixth sense telling me that I am about to hear something very bad. He looks sorry for a minute, then pulls a black and white photograph of a man from the back of the folder. He spins it to face me, and I recognize the face immediately as the same man from the photo of Cass and his dad at the father-son cookout. Hair slicked to the side, heavy black-rimmed glasses, shirt buttoned all the way to the top. A few seconds ago, I wondered if there were two totally different Cassidy Porters who coincidentally lived in this area of Maine, one who attacked me and one who saved me. But now I know that's not probable because this man is connected to one by DNA and the other by a photo I've seen with my own eyes. It's all somehow connected, though I haven't the slightest idea how to unravel it.
Miss Cadogan.
I recognize him, I murmur. Marty sighs heavily.
Ain't no good way to say this, I guess, but that man right there... Paul Isaac Porter was a convicted serial killer. Killed over a dozen women. Arrested in 1998, tried and convicted back in 1999, killed in a prison fight in 2000 while awaiting execution.
You're saying...
Cassidy Porter's father was a serial killer.
My entire motherfucking universe spins out of control as my feeble, overworked, aching mind tries to process what the fuck is going on here. What the actual, ever-loving fuck is being said to me? Paul Isaac Porter was a convicted serial killer, killed over a dozen women. Cassidy Porter's father was a serial killer. My stomach heaves, surprising us all by emptying its meager contents onto Officer Marty's shoes. I retch and sputter, my tears falling endlessly as I vomit water and bile onto the police station floor.
Christ, Lou. Get the mop. She's sick.
I feel a hand on my shoulder, and a moment later, someone puts an ice pack on the back of my neck. A mop appears by my feet, sopping up the mess, and another cup of cold water is shoved into my hands. I drink cautiously to get rid of the taste in my mouth, then take a handful of tissues from Lou to wipe my face. When I look up at Lou and Marty, I find them staring down at me with concern.
You okay now?
Asks Lou with a kindly grimace. My shoulders are still shaking from the retching and crying. My head is still throbbing, and I can't begin to process the information I've been given. Cassidy's father was a serial killer. And Cassidy isn't Cassidy. Then who? Who? It's too much. All I want is a hot shower and to fall asleep wrapped up in my mother's arms. I need my mom, I sob. Please.
Yeah, of course, says Marty.
He turns to Lou, throwing him a set of keys.
Will you bring my car around to the front?
Lou hustles off, and Marty looks at me.
It'll just be a minute.
Thank you. He sits down across from me again.
To be honest, it wasn't such a huge surprise that the son of a serial killer would get into some trouble of his own. We heard from the Bennington and Williams kids that Cassidy Porter was harassing hikers that day down at Roaring Brook. We figured he got into it with someone on the AT and ended up falling on his own knife.
No. I whisper, recalling Cassidy's retelling of what happened after I blacked out. He was thrown.
Thrown?
I nod slowly. Cassidy? I look up at Marty and blink twice. I mean, the man who saved me. He caught my attacker stabbing me and threw him off my body. Wayne? The dead man. I cannot bear to call him Cassidy. Must have landed on his knife.
Well, no other prints on the knife but his, so you're probably right. It's a closed case now. He attacked you, fell on his knife. Thrown, whatever. Ask me, he got what was coming to him. Just glad that other fella come along when he did. He's a hero for saving you.
That other fella. A hero. Cassidy. My Cass. Except he isn't my Cass. His name might not be Cassidy at all. I have no idea who he is, and I wonder if he even knows who he is. I look up at Marty. Who saved me? I ask in a whisper, more to myself, maybe, than to him. Marty shuts the folder on his desk and picks up his pen again, holding it over the notepad for a moment before drawing a large question mark.
I think we've got a bit of a mystery there. You say that the man who attacked you was called Wayne, and that Cassidy Porter saved you. Only that's scientifically impossible. I can't rightly say who saved you or why in the world he goes by the name of Cassidy Porter.
He shrugs.
Just count your lucky stars he found you when he did.
I gulp, staring up at him, letting tears of exhaustion, confusion, and sorrow slide down my face.
I guess you have a guardian angel, he says,
giving me a kind smile as Lou returns to tell us that the car is waiting. I follow Marty through the station to the waiting car, letting him open the rear door and slump into the back seat as I look out the window. More useless tears stream from my eyes. I have a beautiful, nameless guardian angel hero whom I love, who left me here, who doesn't know who he really is, who is as lost to himself as he is to me. Chapter 30. Bryn.
Bryn, sweetheart, do you need anything?
My mom asks through the bathroom door. She's hovering.
Not that I blame her, but I need a little bit of alone time after, one, being abandoned by Cassidy, two, my disturbing, illuminating conversation with Officer Marty, and three, the intense reunion I just had with my parents. I'm okay, Mom. I'll be out soon.
Your dad got back with the clothes. He found, some shorts and a t-shirt at the gift shop.
Okay, I say. Thank you.
Well, sweetheart, take your time. We'll be right out here. Call if you need something.
Thanks, Mom. I've been soaking in their hotel tub for about 20 minutes, keeping my bandaged wrist out of the water. The rest of my tired, aching body feels like it could stay in the hot water for days. Officer Marty called ahead to the Ferguson Lake Lodge as he drove me over, and my parents were waiting at the front door. I fell into their arms the moment I exited the police car. All of us crying, and my mother leaning back again and again to cradle my face in her palms and assure herself that I was here and alive. We feared the worst. Back from the dead. What happened? I returned the blanket to Officer Marty, who advised again that I make a stop at Millinocket General Hospital to have a checkup, but I don't believe that's necessary. My stab wounds are healing nicely, and I feel fine. I mean, my body feels fine. My heart is broken. And my mind? My God, my mind can't stop spinning. I can't seem to fit all the pieces together on one hand, but on the other, so many of my questions have suddenly been answered. No matter who my Cassidy is, I know one thing for certain. He believes that he is Cassidy Porter, the son of convicted serial killer Paul Isaac Porter. Perhaps he is a second son of Paul Porter? It's possible, but it doesn't feel right. Cassidy was the exact opposite of evil. He was all goodness, through and through. I can't imagine even a cell of Paul Porter's evil nature alive in Cass. More likely, I think he might be a second son of Rosemary Cleary Porter, the mother for whom he felt a real, strong, and genuine affection. But why would she name two of her sons Cassidy? It doesn't make any sense. What does make sense, suddenly, is the way Cassidy refused to talk about his father, always changing the subject when I tried to mention him. That father-son picture was of my Cassidy standing beside his father, a serial killer. No wonder I sensed uneasiness in his posture. Did he know what his father was? My God, he lived for years with a monster. Did he sense it? When did he find out? I take a shaking breath, wondering what he has seen in his life, the horror he has possibly known. Because I can't bear it, I switch gears and put together the pieces of his timeline that were missing. He was born in 1990, and the picture at the cookout was taken in 1995, the same year as the portrait of him with his mother and grandfather. The newspaper photo from the Little League game was in 1997, and from the normal, everyday way it referred to his parents, I think it's safe to assume that Paul Isaac Porter was keeping his crimes under wraps at that point. He was arrested in 1998, convicted in 1999, and killed in a prison fight in 2000. But Cassidy moved to the cabin in 1999 without his father. My mother didn't feel comfortable living alone in town. He and his mother likely never returned to civilization because his surname was feared and notorious. So many things make sense now. How he changed the subject every time I asked about his father. Why he doesn't want to be around people. Why he isolates himself from society. I can only imagine the weight of the name Porter on an innocent little boy's shoulders. Innocent. A terrible thought occurs to me, and I let it take shape in my mind because it makes sense to me, though it also breaks my heart. You are better off without me. I promise. For both our sakes, please don't come looking for me. Does Cassidy bear some guilt for his father's choices? Surely he knows that he is innocent of his father's terrible crimes. My mind segues to the dozens of books on DNA and genetics in his living room. I remember asking if one of his parents was a geneticist, but he said no. And since his father never lived at the homestead, those books belonged to someone else. His grandfather? His mother? One of them was obsessed with DNA and genetics. Why? I whimper with growing understanding and profound, twisting sorrow as puzzle pieces snap together, giving me a more complete picture of Cassidy's upbringing. When your son/grandson has a serial killer for a father, you can't help but wonder how he's going to turn out. I flip through different moments with Cassidy in mind. I trust you, I said to him on the first day I was fully conscious at his house. You probably shouldn't, he grimly answered. And in the beginning, he reassured me endlessly that he wouldn't hurt me. It was almost a mantra. At one point, he even said, I just like living out here is all. I won't hurt you, Bryn. I'm not some psycho. Not yet, anyway. I promise. That curious not yet has new meaning to me now. Some stories have really bad endings, he said when I asked if he had a story to tell me. He meant his story, the story of him and his parents. And the way he always said that he wished things were different makes sense now, too. He wouldn't have sex with me without a condom. He was adamant about it, and when I asked why, he bluntly said, I'm not getting you pregnant. And during our horrible, blistering fight in the kitchen, he practically screamed, We can't be together. I can't love you. I can't be with anyone. Even the reason he finally flipped out, yelling at me and raising his shaking fist between us, I was talking about having kids. That's what made him snap. Oh my God. It's all connected, I realized in a startling burst of clarity. The DNA books, his promises not to hurt me, wishing things were different, not risking impregnating me, the conviction that he couldn't be with anyone, and the fierce and furious panic at the notion of having children. Oh, Cass, I murmur as my tired eyes blur with tears. Who told you that you had to stay unloved? Who made you believe that you would make the same choice as your father did? And who told you that any children you had would be poisoned too? The answer? Someone traumatized by the true nature of her husband or his son-in-law had taken it upon themselves to inject this venom into Cassidy's mind, to make him believe that the son of a serial killer had no right to happiness and barely any right to life. The stark, cruel, brutal unfairness of it makes my heart stutter. Cass, I sob, understanding why he fought his feelings for me, knowing why he pushed me away. I think, my God, this is so sad I can't keep from crying, but I think he did it to keep me safe. From himself. The one man who I know in the depths of my heart would never hurt me. You asked if I love you, and the answer is yes, so much that I have to let you go. You are better off without me, I promise. For both our sakes, please don't come looking for me. I wipe away my tears, lift my chin, and lean forward to drain the bath. Except I know things about my Cassidy now that he doesn't even know. The first is that I am not better off without him, and the second is that I am damn well going to start looking for him as soon as I figure out who he really is.
So you're saying that the man who attacked you and the man who saved you are the same person?
Asks my mother. Her eyebrows deeply furrowed, her voice terse and confused. No, I say, shaking my head. I am sitting on their king-size hotel bed, cross-legged in a bathrobe, facing my parents, to whom I've been trying to explain this crazy story for about an hour. No. Follow me, Mom. The man who attacked me was born Cassidy Porter, but we're going to call him Wayne, okay? Wayne was the biological son of a serial killer.
Which makes a certain amount of sense, considering he tried to kill you, Bug,
That's right, Dad.
What about Jem?
My mother asks, her voice perturbed.
You say you love this mountain man, this serial killer's son, but you've been grieving Jem for 2 years, worrying us sick. I can't keep up with...
Mom, I say gently, I know it's a lot to process. Of course I loved Jem, and part of me always will, but Jem's been gone for years. Meeting Cassidy and falling in love with him? I sigh, trying to organize my thoughts so I can catch her up to where I am. In a weird way, I feel like Jem was part of the journey to Cass. If I hadn't loved him so much, I never would have come here. I never would have met Cassidy. He saved my life. He made me want to live. He is such a good man, and he understands me in ways that are so deep and unexpected. I'm scared of losing him. I'm terrified I'll never find anyone else who will complete me like he does. I love him. I want to be with him, and if he knew who he really was, I think he'd want to be with me too. My dad pats my leg.
I'm following, Bug. And I have to say, I haven't seen you this fired up, this alive, since, well, since before you lost Jem. Whoever this Cassidy is, I want to meet him. I want to thank the man who saved my girl.
My father has always gotten me, and I give him a grateful smile, then turn to my mom. I'm sorry I worried you, but the way Jem died was so shocking, so violent, it took years for me to process it, and I had to do that my own way. The thing is, though, by the time I finally said goodbye to Jem, I realized I'd already said goodbye to him in my heart a while ago. It just took coming here to realize that. To realize that my heart was ready for someone new. For Cassidy.
Sweetheart, says my mom after a long, dismissive sigh. This is just all so sad and upsetting. Listen, how about we order some room service and catch up a little? Your cousin Belle's boyfriend didn't work out. She's got a new one now, Keith, or... No, that's not it. Anyway, I could catch you up and... Oh! We could watch an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, maybe. We love them.
Sweetheart, we were so worried about you, and then we got that strange phone message, and now you're here, safe and sound. Can we just... No, Mom, I say, reaching out to put my hand on her arm and curling my fingers gently around her wrist. I have to get to the bottom of this. I want... No, I need your help, but if you can't give it, I understand. Either way, I need to figure this out. Now. Today. She yanks her wrist away.
We traveled here all the way from Scottsdale, Bryn. We have been worried sick for 3 weeks, wondering if you were dead or alive. I am not outdoorsy, as you well know, but I have climbed that goddamned, god-awful mountain 6 times in 3 weeks. Is it so much to ask that we take a moment or two to catch our breath and enjoy one another before we have to hear stories about stabbing attacks and serial killers and this Cassidy person?
She jumps off the bed, standing at the foot with her arms crossed.
I don't think I'm being unreasonable.
I share a look with my dad, silently begging for him to help. I love my parents, and truly I am so grateful that they're here. But I feel like the clock is ticking down on figuring out who Cassidy is and finding him, which is going to be a challenge of its own. But I definitely don't want to sit around watching the Kardashians and eating chicken salad croissants when the love of my life has based his entire existence on lies and has probably pushed me away because he is convinced that he isn't worthy of my love.
Muffin,
says my dad, standing up and pulling my mother's stiff body awkwardly into his arms.
You go on down to the dining room and have a nice lunch now. Maybe a cold Chardonnay, too. Come back when you're ready. I'm going to stay here and listen to what Bryn Bug's got to say.
I'm not letting her out of my sight, my mother screeches.
Then Muffin, he says gently as he plops a kiss on her forehead. I think you're going to have to get on board with solving this mystery, because our girl seems determined.
My mother takes a deep breath and huffs.
Well, may I at least order us some room service?
I'd love it, Mom. Thank you. I smile at her back as she heads into the living room of the suite, then turn to my father. Thanks, Dad. He waves away my thanks.
So, let me make sure I understand. Wayne attacked you and is dead. Cassidy saved you and is alive.
Yes. Thank God.
Further, Wayne was the biological son of this Paul Porter, but Cassidy is not?
I shrug my shoulders. I don't know. I don't know if Paul Porter and my Cassidy were blood related, but I do know that Cassidy believed that Paul, the serial killer, was his father. I saw a picture of them together at a cookout back in 1995. Plus, Cassidy was really cagey about his father, didn't want to discuss him, changed the subject every time I tried.
Buck,
says my dad, his eyes worried.
You sure you want to go digging around in this? Could be you find something you don't want to.
Like what?
Like?
He takes a deep breath, his lips grim.
What if he is the son of a serial killer?
It's a good question. And maybe for another woman, the answer wouldn't come easily, but I know my heart. I don't skip a beat before answering. I don't care, I say, the words rushed and breathless because I want my dad to hear them. He's still the man who saved me. He's still the man who took care of me. He's still the man I love. I don't care who his father was. Dad, if you knew him, how selfless he is, how smart and capable, how he makes me feel.
I get it, Bug. I want the best for you,
he says, his eyes worried as he runs a hand through his still dashing silver hair. I love him, Dad, I murmur again, staring into green eyes so similar to my own as I finger the bracelet on my wrist.
Your mom made a good point,
he says, the eagle-eyed gaze that has served him so well in the courtroom pinning me now.
You loved Jem the last time we talked to you. How do you know this isn't some infatuation?
I try not to feel defensive, because I know that my feelings for Cassidy are real, but my parents deserve a little bit of time to catch up with how drastically my heart has changed in a matter of weeks. I keep my voice measured and gentle. Like I said, I'll always love Jem. He was a good man, and we... Hope's musings about the relative happiness of Jem's and my union come rushing back. I think we would have been happy. But Jem is gone. I pause for a moment to let my words sink in before I continue. But Dad, I'm a 30-year-old woman. I know myself. I'm in love with Cassidy. I've got to give us a real chance. I'll never be able to move on from this if I don't. I'll be stuck here, wondering about him for the rest of my life.
Okay,
my dad nods, and I can see in his eyes that I've won him over.
I hear you, Bug. I'm in. Tell me more.
3 pancake platters and a pot of coffee on the way, says my mom, rejoining us in the bedroom.
That's just fine, Muffin,
says my dad as she sits back down beside him on the bed.
Now, Jenny, you read all those mystery stories. What do you make of all this?
She shrugs, then purses her lips.
Why did your attacker call himself Wayne?
I stare at her for a moment, blinking, feeling annoyed. With all the questions that could be asked, she's focusing on Wayne's alias?
Mom, I really think there are more.
I mean, she continues, deep in thought,
your Cassidy really believes he's Cassidy, right? Did Wayne really believe he was Wayne?
All of the wind in my sails of indignation flits away. She's right. It's a damn good question.
Where did that officer say that Cassidy Porter was born?
Dad asks. Here, in Millinocket.
I wonder.
Hums my mother. What?
Well, if there's a birth record on file for Cassidy Porter, you might stop in and see if there's a birth record for someone named Wayne, she says. After breakfast, of course.
I lean forward and kiss her cheek, feeling hopeful for the first time since waking up this morning at the Millinocket Police Department. You're brilliant, Mom.
Nice work, Muffin,
adds my dad, squeezing her shoulders. She blushes, happy to have helped, then tells me to go get dressed.
And while we're having breakfast, I want to hear more about this man who saved you, she calls as I head in.